Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. I'm Paula. Challenges to humans' survival are as old as our species. What is new is the threat to our existence. Michelle Goldberg says that one effective way of addressing these challenges is by extending basic human rights to the female half of the world's population.
During the Cold War, the United States supported people around the world who were fighting for values that the United States upheld within their own societies. And sometimes we did that in a really outrageous way in terms of supporting dictators, but sometimes it just meant supporting, you know, liberal journals in the Eastern Bloc or supporting, you know, cultural dissidents. And I would say that what's called for here is something similar, not a kind of tyrannical or arrogant approach, but just an approach to support the women and the people who are making changes within their own societies. And in part because the people on the other sides, the people who are ostensibly fighting for the authenticity of their cultures, are increasingly globalized and increasingly have their own means of support, whether that support is coming from American evangelicals, from the Vatican, from Iran, or from Saudi Arabia.
Investigative journalist Michelle Goldberg is the author of The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. Her prior book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, was a New York Times bestseller. A former senior writer at Salon.com, among the many who have published her work are The Nation, Glamour, and Rolling Stone magazines in the U.S., and The Guardian in the U.K. Bill Russell and I were pleased to explore with Ms. Goldberg the possibilities available to half the world's population and the benefits to all of us. Michelle Goldberg, not long ago, actually it was this morning, I saw a young man, African-American, probably 20-something, who had a backpack, and the back of it said, "Only One World." And I thought, oh, great, this kid gets the environmental movement. Had I not been reading The Means of Reproduction and looking forward to meeting you, I would have gone through the whole litany in my head of, it's good for the planet, it's environmental. My first thought was, I wonder how he feels about women's rights. Mm-hmm. Why would I make that leap?
And he probably, well, who knows, but the chances are he's never really thought about that. Because one thing people don't connect women's rights to all of these much greater issues of globalization and war and peace and poverty and development and environmental destruction. Whereas what I try to argue in this book and try to kind of show in this book is that women's rights and the liberation of women is actually at the core, is the key to the solution, or at least to a beginning of the solution of all these other massive problems kind of menacing humanity.
It's easy for folks to kind of get overwhelmed by, as you say, all of these tremendous challenges that just are daunting on a good day. We could enumerate them, but it isn't intuitively obvious that the rights of women is the key. Where'd you figure that out?
I guess, a couple of places. And a couple of different strains came together in writing this book. I mean, on the one hand, you started to hear it a lot from economists. Even Lawrence Summers, who feminists groaned about Lawrence Summers when he spoke about, you know, women not being as good at math, basically.
Well, he lost his job at Harvard, so.
Right, but actually, Lawrence Summers, who kind of nobody's going to mistake for a radical feminist, you know, back when he was at the World Bank, was saying that there is no other investment with as many dividends as investing in women's rights. And this is something you hear kind of, you know, Amartya Sen, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics, has also talked about women's rights being, and so part of it was that I kept hearing this and wanted to understand how it worked.
From economists.
From economists, which is interesting, because you don't think about economists as being, you know, mushy and, you know.
Not usually.
Right, so as economists, but the message wasn't necessarily filtering down, and part of that is because economists don't really tell stories, you know, they make models and crunch numbers and things like that. So that's part of it, and then on the other side, there was just the fact that I had seen, you know, having written my first book, which was about religious fundamentalism in American politics, I had seen those movements kind of increasingly branch out and get involved globally. I had seen all of these really fiercely fought debates at the United Nations over women's rights, but was not quite sure what impact they actually have on the ground. You know, some of it can seem, sometimes it can seem like shadow boxing. You're having these fierce bureaucratic debates over a line in a resolution, or, and it just seems so removed from real life. So all of those things which had been, you know, kind of floating around in my head, I was able to make enough sense of them to get a book proposal together. And then in this book, I was able to explore them really fully and show how they all kind of interweaved, how they interweave. And again, how, you know, something that goes on in a conference room at the United Nations where the United States is involved and the Vatican is involved and these Muslim countries are involved, how that translates into the life of, say, a woman on the ground in, you know, Managua or in a village in Kenya.
So you were learning as you were moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, that's, at least for me, that's how these books are written too, so I shouldn't say always, but that's how the process works. You know, you can't, it's a, and so books kind of are always this, like, evolutionary journey, and I'm really, really lucky that I've had the support to do two of them, because in a way someone's, you know, taking a gamble that you're going to find something worth, you know, worth publicizing.
I read this, and I found myself trying to step back and say, you know, what's the general solution to this? And the piece that just jumped out at me is we're talking about human rights in general. Mm-hmm. And the disconnect seems to be that there are a lot of people who don't want to connect women and humans. that somehow or other women are exempt from human rights. But the human rights most of us talk about, and all these organizations talk about, if most of those rights were just as a matter of course applied to women, it seems that a lot of the challenges, the many challenges that you write about would go away.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of astonishing that that would be in any way controversial. I mean, remember when Hillary Clinton went to Beijing in 1995 and she gave that speech, which kind of electrified the crowd, electrified people around the world, when she said, you know, women's rights are human rights and human rights are women's rights once and for all. And in a way that sounds almost banal in its obviousness, but it was actually
considered... It's a tautology from, I mean,
well, yes,
logically.
Right. The rights of half the human race are human rights. But... Right, it should seem like a tautology, but it was actually, the very fact that it was revolutionary and that it was considered very brave shows the extent to which women have not been and are not understood as fully human in huge parts of the world. And people seem to have the idea that, you know, the oppression of racial minorities or religious minorities or all of these things are violations of human rights, but the oppression of women is culture. And, you know, we have to respect other people's cultures.
That has tremendous implications. Go ahead, Bill.
You made an interesting point to me that people who are looking backwards, extreme conservatives, people who don't want change, talk about culture, which means the rest of us don't have culture. And I would argue, assuming the world is not absolutely static.
Right.
And the historical evidence is such that one would sort of have to believe that change does happen, then I'm as entitled to a culture, perhaps a dynamic culture, and perhaps a different culture, but I'm as entitled to a culture as anyone else.
And that's one of the points I try to make in this book, is that, you know, there are women in every country I've ever been to, and I think in every country in the world, you know, I mean, maybe they're not able to do anything in North Korea, but, you know, even in the Sudan, even in Saudi Arabia, really everywhere, you have women fighting to change their cultures from within, and it's so condescending and insulting to them to act as if only kind of the most reactionary forces in their cultures are authentic, and... You know, we believe our culture capable of changing and evolving. We should kind of extend the same confidence to other, you know, and assume that, yes, other cultures can evolve and progress and change and be dynamic without being destroyed, just as we think ours can be.
I think it's probably important to say, what are these specific issues? What are the kinds of things that we're arguing about? To say women's rights, there are real particular
elements. Women's rights can be so vague. And actually, a lot of the language is difficult because a lot of, you know, people don't know the entire arc of this thing. So, but let's talk specifically. We're talking about family planning and family planning, contraception, the right to decide when you have sex, who you have sex with, when you get married, when you have children, how many children you have, how they're spaced. Those are pretty fundamental things. And, you know, in a
and
way,
you're saying those are rights.
Yes, actually, yes. The idea that reproductive rights are human rights is not just something, and it's not just something I'm arguing for. I mean, it's something I'm kind of, one of the things I think is not well realized is that over the last few years, reproductive rights are increasingly kind of enshrined in international law.
They are
enshrined. In international law. And even abortion rights, increasingly, you've had various international human rights bodies rule that women who've been denied abortions that they need to, that they need for various health reasons, have been, have had their human rights violated.
I want to stop you there and go away so that we can come right back, because
okay.
we are right at the heart of what is explosive for people around the world, and also a vision of possibility for some of those other people around the world. Mm-hmm. We're going to be right back with Michelle Goldberg. We are talking about the many big ideas that she has brought together in her book, The Means of Reproduction, the subtitle of which I love, mm-hmm. Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. Be back with us in a moment. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be with Michelle Goldberg. We went away at the idea that reproductive rights are at the heart for women. And can you say reproductive rights for men in this context?
Yes and no. I mean, certainly, you know, men are also part of families, and also as families, they need access to family planning. And, you know, and need to be involved. And I don't want to set this up as being kind of a case of eternal hostility between men and women. You know, there are often tensions between men and women and families. Their interests are not always aligned, but...
There are often tensions within families.
Right, but you know, often they are aligned. And men also need access to these services. At the same time, there's also a question of women needing... to be able to make certain reproductive decisions and sexual decisions irrespective of men. You know, a case that we've been seeing just recently in the media is what's happening in Afghanistan in the last couple of weeks, where Hamid Karzai has signed this Shiite personal status law that gives men, or that basically sanctions spousal rape, that says women don't have the right to refuse sex to their husbands. And people have been very up in arms, as they should be, but actually... There's very, most countries, many, many developing countries do not criminalize spousal rape. And so, you know...
But there was a time when that was simply an oxymoron.
Oh, right. I mean, I think it's only been criminalized in this country for about, what, 3 decades now? It's not as if, you know, this is kind of back in the, in medieval times. And so, yes, although partly we're talking about reproductive rights for couples and for families, but we're also talking about... you know, reproductive autonomy for women.
This goes back to human rights. I mean, forcing somebody to have sex, no matter what gender, would seem to be a violation of human rights. Does that work?
Yeah, absolutely.
is it hard?
Well, and then the other piece of that, though, is that, you know, if you say that women have the right to, if women have the right to decide the number and spacing of their children, which is, you know, the wording of a human rights declaration that was signed, I believe, in the 60s in Tehran. So if you believe that this, if you believe that this is true, then that it follows from that that they need some way to do that, you know, that there needs to be some kind of implementation, which means there needs to be access to family planning and contraception, which are things that are so easily available here that we take them for granted and don't understand how politicized and how fraught access to family planning services is around the world.
And, that's before you talk about abortion.
Yes, absolutely. We're talking for... and although actually the two things are intimately related, because in places where you don't have really good family planning infrastructure, you have very high rates of abortion, and particularly very high rates of unsafe and often deadly abortion.
And very high rates, to just amplify what you're saying, women die regularly This is not an abstraction.
No, 70,000 women die every year in the world because of unsafe abortion. And I've been to countries, it's especially acute, actually, in sub-Saharan Africa and particularly in East Africa. I've been to, you know, gynecological wards in Nairobi or Addis Ababa and talked to doctors who say that, you know, in the wards that deal with obstetric, you know, gynecological and obstetric emergencies, they spend most of their time cleaning up botched abortions, treating women who've had botched abortions. And so not only is this a kind of a hideous tragedy for so many women whose health is being, you know, ravaged, but I mean, imagine the drain on these health systems, which don't have, you know, which can hardly afford to be wasting money, especially, you know, there's many causes of maternal mortality, right? Unsafe abortion globally is about 13% of maternal mortality. So it's a major cause, but not the major cause. But it's the only major cause that can be really significantly fixed with just a few strokes of the pen. You know, change a few laws, promulgate a few new policies, and you can make this huge dent in this otherwise, you know, kind of gross and intractable problem that we're failing all over the world to really address.
And yet you make it sound easy, and it's the toughest thing of all.
And it is the toughest thing of all. And it's, I think it goes back again to women, you know, I think in traditional societies, in religious societies, despite the attempts of some feminists in the past to find some kind of pre-modern matriarchal goddess culture, I actually don't think that exists. Most societies and most traditions and most religions have very strict gender hierarchies and very strict divisions of gender roles.
And the idea of patriarchy is at the heart of these hierarchies.
It is. And the modern world, I can see you disagree, but
no, I don't.
What modernism does and globalization and all these different forces are, is that it upsets those hierarchies. It equalizes gender roles. It kind of narrows some of the kind of gulf between what men do and what women do. And so the easiest way, the most obvious way to fight back against these changes that are so disturbing to fundamentalist movements and conservative movements is to, you know, put women back in their place. And so, which is why I think I show in this book these debates about abortion that are going on all over the world. You know, they're going on in Africa, they're going on in Europe, they're going on in Latin America.
They're going in the United States.
They're going on in the United States. And you have many of the same players. You know, you have kind of globalized forces on both sides. But they're often, you know, as much as they're about the value of the fetus and about life, they're just as often about, you know, kind of modernity and sovereignty and who gets to make decisions about what kind of a culture we live in, and, you know, things have gotten out of control and we need somehow to impose some kind of order on what seems like sexual chaos.
Cultural piece of this, listening to you and reading this, essentially goes back to brute force. And the everything else aside, and so the women who are not effectively humans are chattel.
Mm-hmm.
And this country has some experience in that, lots of different ways. And it seems to me that, to oversimplify this, a lot of this is a wholesale attempt to move beyond a brute force model of how societies work.
I think that that's true. And I also think that that brute force model, there was a reason for it. I mean, it was... you know, cruel and unfair, but it also made a certain amount of sense in kind of agricultural societies where, you know, the person who could control the most women and have the most children, had the most resources, could subdue more of the land, could produce more. You know, it was a model that was in many ways, you know, unfair and unjust and caused people a great deal of pain, but made a kind of, you know, evolutionary sense, if you will.
This is Darwinian.
Right. And what I think we've reached a point now, you know, 2008 was the year in which more than half the human population came to live in cities. You know, big families are no longer, in most cases, an economic boon. They're an economic drain.
They're not selected for.
Right, so I think that this kind of brute force model has actually, we've reached a point where it's become maladaptive.
I loved seeing that. Let's see. The problems of women being treated unequally is maladaptive. That kind of takes it into a place. Well, of course, those who are committed anti-evolutionists find that problematical. But to think of that outside of theological rhetoric, mm-hmm. and to say what works for everybody and the planet and the species. Bill, you were...
You were talking about economics earlier. And there's an important piece, there are lots of important pieces with respect to this country. The discussions about population, particularly populations in developed countries, and the fear that we're graying and a lot of other things, the information you provide is, to me, new information.
We're going to come back in just a moment and talk more about population, both too many and too few.
And new information.
New information about both in just a moment here on The Paula Gordon Show with Michelle Goldberg. Be with us. We'll be right back. We're back with Michelle Goldberg. Bill Russell was talking about population. We used to worry about too many, then we worry about too few, and now we worried about too many, and this is more complex.
This discussion is about, to me, I'm trying on the subject, it's about the Enlightenment and using evidence as a basis for making decisions. Mm-hmm. And what you presented...
You're not trite, Bill, you're just regular.
Consistent. And what you, the evidence you provide, it, to me, is just a remarkably clarifying about how to address the fear-mongering that's going on, mm-hmm. particularly in Europe, in this country.
Well, the thing that I find truly amazing, and that I didn't necessarily realize when I set out to start this book, is that it turns out that women's rights are, and kind of giving women, you know, control over their own bodies, over their own reproductive lives, is the answer to overpopulation. And we can see that to some degree. That's a little more intuitive. But it turns out that it's also the answer to rapid population decline, which is also actually a problem. And
you don't often hear that that's a problem, so it helped me to be thinking of... Well, you do.
You don't hang out on the wrong
I mean, and that's the thing. This is so polarized in that the left sees overpopulation as a problem.
Well, it's killing the planet.
And the right, has often been kind of in denial, at least since the rise. The religious right insists that there is no such thing as overpopulation. In fact, the real problem is rapid population decline. And the tricky thing is that it can sound really racist and outrageous to say that we have a problem, with too few Europeans and, you know, kind of too many people in the developing countries. The fact is that the population of the Earth is not shrinking. You know, we're gonna top 9 billion within the next 40 years. And at the same time, rapid population decline in certain countries is also a problem. Not so much because of the absolute numbers, but because of the aid structures. You know, if you care about European social welfare policies and things like that, you cannot have this kind of, triangle-shaped population structure with very few young people supporting all of these old people. And immigration can address this to some extent, but, you know, one of the numbers I had in the book is that if Italy's 1995 birth rate was consistent over 100 years, Italy would shrink to 14% of its current population. So if you want to bring in the immigrants to make that up, you know, I think I'm a big believer in, like, really large-scale immigration, but you can't do it so quickly that you ignite huge nationalist backlashes, which you're bound to do.
And so, well, and you talk about culture. Culture is all over that.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and it's not, I actually don't think it's outrageous for people to want to, you know, people have to be flexible, and there's, you know, European culture is going to change, but I don't see anything outrageous or completely ethnocentric about people wanting to preserve some of the great values of European culture, you know, equality, feminism, gay rights, social democracy. But what we see, and what I think is so interesting, is that the right has been obsessed with population decline for a long time in Europe, and they're constantly using it to say that, you know, feminism is precipitating the death of Western civilization, Europe is going to be overrun by Muslims who are outbreeding us. But what we see is that after a certain level of development, there is an inverse correlation, or there's a direct correlation between patriarchy and rapid population decline. You know, in countries like where there is where a certain level of development and kind of modernization has been reached, but that haven't had similar evolutions in kind of gender roles and social dynamics. You know, in countries like Poland, Japan,
Italy, Spain.
You know, it's not a coincidence that a lot of these are Catholic countries where women want to combine work and family, but the infrastructure and the social attitudes and the government policies to support that don't exist. They're not having children. I call that chapter the birth strike. In countries that do make generous allowances for working women, you know, France, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, birth rates are actually totally sustainable. And so, again, what we see is that if you're really worried about overpopulation and if you're worried about underpopulation, women's rights are the answer. And the deeper message, I think, is that when you give women kind of control over their own fertility, they will make the right decisions. You know, things will stabilize. You know, people talk about feminism as if it was this kind of destabilizing and chaotic force. And if we could just go back to this earlier way, we would all live in harmony. Whereas, in fact, I think that in today's world, women's rights are kind of a harmonizing and a stabilizing force.
Well, again, human rights.
Yeah, the human rights of women, we should say.
The human rights applied to, let us say, all humans.
Mm-hmm.
There's another piece that you don't, a point that I don't think you make. It seems to me part of this demographic problem is the retirement and supporting an aging population. Part of the cure for that is to bring more women into the workforce. If women were participating at the same level as men, it's still a challenge, but it is not as much of a challenge. And that participation, again, the statistics of this seem to be fairly clear.
Participating as equals, so they would be getting the same kinds of incomes and the.
Well, first participation,
yeah.
Equality is longer, but yes, ultimately as equals as a human right, but just the ability to participate would seem to be it has two advantages. One, it addresses the pension problem, and secondly, it addresses the birth. And what you're saying is the sweet spot in population centers around empowered women.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the reason that Sweden initially adopted all these really family-friendly policies was not because they were so much concerned with feminism as that they had a labor shortage. And so they, you know, realized they needed to recruit women into the workforce on a big scale. Germany also had a labor shortage, didn't want to do that, you know, had this kind of Christian social democratic tradition, so instead decided to rely on massive numbers of guest workers, and which has created, you know, all kinds of other problems for Germany, whereas, in Sweden, these policies, which weren't necessarily designed to empower women, but had that as a kind of corollary effect, have had just a whole host of beneficial effects on the health of the society.
Of course, the right wing just delights in pointing to Sweden as the arch bad guy, and yet you've got to have somebody who's been willing to do the experiments and say, "Well, you know, it works."
Yeah, and it's really amazing. I mean, one really wonders what exactly is this dystopia that they're imagining? You know, this dystopia of high education rates, low poverty rates, better health care than we have. You know, Sweden is not a perfect society, and there are things I prefer about the United States. You know, I prefer its dynamism, its immigration, its multiculturalism, but we have a lot to learn from Scandinavia.
We also have a lot to learn from our history. It is interesting to me, we don't dwell on this, but you say that the right wing has effectively taken on a Marxist argument.
Well, this is really something so interesting when you start looking at the history and you look at the archives. You know, it used to be that kind of these cold warriors, these national security types in the United States, believed that overpopulation was going to cause so much misery that it was going to lead to communist revolution. We're talking in the 60s and 70s. And so we need to, you know, blanket the developing world with contraception. We need to bring safe abortion all to the world. And the communist argument was that no, overpopulation is not a problem. The real problem is an unjust economic order. You know, at the time, the New York Times at one point characterized it as Marx versus Malthus. And since then, the arguments have completely switched. so that the communist countries, China, China being the kind of greatest example, and China, I think, has done it in an abusive way, but have fully brought into these arguments about overpopulation that they used to reject out of hand, and the United States, especially under Reagan, have become overpopulation denialists, and instead say that the only solution is going to be in laissez-faire free market capitalism.
Michelle Goldberg has much to say. We'll come back for a couple more minutes in a moment. Be with us. We have just a couple more minutes. Michelle Goldberg, Bill Russell, I'm Paula Gordon. You say, in just an elegant way, that the strongest argument for a key to solving all the world's problems is women's rights, and the most radical solution to all these problems is women's rights. Now, you know, in a country that is really committed to fixing things quickly, preferably, to have something that is that diametrically opposed as the answer, that's hard for us.
And I don't mean to present it as something that's kind of a grand plan that the United States needs to impose on the rest of the world. I think, you know, actually, as I said before, there are women in every country in the world who are working to make these changes within, who are doing so in kind of organic ways tailored to their own societies, their own situations. So my point is not, you know, that we need to, you know, invade these countries to empower women, or that we need to, you know, kind of Bigfoot.
Cultural imperialism doesn't need to be the answer.
Right. The answer is, you know, and here I'm going to make kind of maybe somewhat like controversial Cold War analogy, but during the Cold War, the United States supported people around the world who were fighting for values that the United States upheld within their own societies. You know, and sometimes we did that in a really outrageous way in terms of supporting dictators, but sometimes it just meant supporting, you know, liberal journals in the Eastern Bloc, or supporting, you know, cultural dissidents. And I would say that what's called for here is something similar. Not, you know, not a kind of tyrannical or arrogant approach, but just an approach to support the women and the people who are making changes within their own societies. And in part because the people on the other sides, the people who are ostensibly fighting for the authenticity of their cultures, are increasingly globalized and increasingly have their own means of support, whether that support is coming from American evangelicals, from the Vatican, from Iran, or from Saudi Arabia.
You don't talk about it. One of the great threats to population, to these numbers, the projections, the 9 billions, of course, is a global pandemic. We have friends who are virologists who say it's coming. It's just a matter of when. The deaths will be in the hundreds of millions, probably, if in fact occurs, and a lot of people expect it. One of the wonderful things about the health piece of this, both specifically with respect to women and their children, is that it would allow us to put in place the infrastructure that will allow us to deal with the catastrophe that we know is coming, and at least in this country and many other countries, we're absolutely unprepared for.
To be honest, that's a little bit beyond my area of expertise. Right. But the one thing that I would say is that
I'm just saying there are tangential benefits.
Right. No, almost certain. I mean, there's like third and fourth and fifth order benefits to all of these things. And, you know, one of the kind of tragedies of our approach to HIV is that in many cases, because family planning had become so politicized, rather than totally taking advantage of the architecture that already existed, you know, the Bush administration created a whole other architecture in order not to taint, you know, our kind of AIDS initiative with these, you know, other initiatives that they found very controversial. And so, yeah, I mean, those same infrastructures can be used, presumably, to do all kinds of other work in public health. And I guess that's in part the key of it is to treat this as a major, to treat reproductive rights as a major public health issue, which is what they are, more than they are a religious issue or an issue of cultural imperialism. This is, you know, a kind of public health crisis. It's a huge public health problem with huge benefits for relatively simple solutions that we know how to enact. you know, we should get on with it.
Sex, sex, power, the future of the world. Bill?
This is a complex ecology. And we're talking, you know, reproduction in a complex ecology in an evolving world is dead center of our chances of surviving, not surviving, improving, not improving.
Well, and the complexity is part of the reason why I think it's important to be humble about solutions and to focus at the grassroots and focus on the kind of organic responses that are already bubbling up rather than come gallivanting in with our own, you know, kind of radical attempts to reorder the way things are, the way people are doing things.
Trust the force.
Trust evolution and work like hell.
That's right. Michelle Goldberg, come back when we have more time together. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much.
In the 300-year-old spirit of the Enlightenment, Michelle Goldberg has done what we should expect of good journalists. She has gone out to find the evidence, which allows us, requires us, to separate the truthful from the blatantly false. We thank her. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.